Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. There's been a lot of talk ever since these trials started about the mismanagement of these cases by the prosecutor's office, by state's attorney Marilyn Mosby. There are people in our political world, especially in the much more conservative parts of our political world, that are calling for her head, saying she should resign. That she, at the very least, was a big op-ed in The Sun saying that she and her office should be investigated, and we'll talk about that. But why is that happening? And are these cases being mismanaged? And so we're going to pursue that and also look at what should happen in these remaining cases. They're clearly saying that the remaining cases should be dismissed. I mean, the defense attorneys are. Could that happen? What would that mean if that did happen? And what does it say about the future and how police and prosecutor's office work together, don't work together? They clearly came to very different conclusions on their investigations, the police and Mosby's office. Why was that? What did that mean? And who calls those shots? These are really important issues for the future of justice in our community. We're joined in the studio by A. Dwight Pettit, defense attorney who represents clients in lawsuits against police and many more things. He is also the attorney for Tyrone West Family. Good to see you again, Dwight.
Good to see you, Mark. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Doug Colbert's in the studio, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Good to have you back, Doug.
Thank you, Mark.
And Tom Maronick, Baltimore attorney and host of the Tom Moore Show on CBM, is with us. He joins us by phone for now, but he's on his way over. Tom, good to have you
with us.
Good morning,
everyone. Good morning. Hey, Tom.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 by phone. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Email us to talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. But I really want to hear what you think about why these cases are the way they are. And so, Tom, let me just start with you on, and be safe driving and talking. We don't want anything to happen to you. But the push here. I mean, well, there's an article. There was an op-ed the other morning in The Sun by David Plymire, who is a former Anne Arundel County state's attorney. In 2014, he retired, and he was assistant state's attorney for Anne Arundel County, and then was also a lawyer for many years. So, but he, in his op-ed, said that Marilyn Mosby broke the cardinal rule of a prosecutor under the Maryland Lawyers' Rules of Professional Conduct to, quote, refrain from prosecuting a charge that the prosecutor knows is not supported by probable cause, end quote. And he was talking about the murder charge against Goodson, and also the contradictions between what the state's attorneys were saying at the grand jury and what Detective Danielle Taylor was saying as well, and the sheriff's office. So give us your perspective on that. This is some very serious charges against her.
I think Marilyn Mosby did her diligence as far as trying to see what was there. I think she has a duty as a public servant to proceed with what she believes the charges can sustain. And one of the things we deal with in law is we may feel the facts show one thing, we may feel the facts show something else, but that's a question that the jury gets to decide. And there are plenty of times in my career where I argue one thing and I may not win on every argument, but I may win on part of it. So I don't know all of the details she had in front of her. I do know that as the prosecutor, she needs to present the evidence showing the probable cause to the grand jury, and that has to be done in the correct fashion. If that's what the editorial's referring to, I think we need to get more information. The story has just come out as far as that, but as far as whether she had the right to charge, I think she did. I think the bigger question now is whether she has enough to continue.
Dwight, how do you see it?
Yeah, I would sort of agree with Tom in terms of his statements that he just made, his analysis. I think she definitely had the right to charge, and I think it was a very positive thing that she did for our community, the state, and the nation by charging. And the question now is what evidence is she looking at that could possibly lead to a conviction in the upcoming trial of Rice?
But one of the things is there clearly seems to be a very different viewpoint between her office and the police on what actually occurred, on what the investigation said. I mean, the quote from the city police, Major Stanley Branford, who was in charge of the investigation of Baltimore City Police, was surprised at the seriousness of the charges against the six officers in the middle of their investigation. And I think he wondered aloud whether his 30-person team investigating these cases had missed something that was found by her investigators. I mean, there really is a discrepancy here, and I think that's what people are questioning.
Well, I think from the very moment that Ms. Mosby's office charged those six police officers, there was a loud hue and cry that one might expect from the police union, from the Fraternal Police Order. But we have to keep in mind that when they denounced her on the day of the charges brought, they asked for her removal. They asked that she be disqualified, that the case be moved outside of Baltimore. I mean, there's been a concerted effort from the very beginning of this case not just challenge Ms. Mosby, but it's gotten as extreme as the FOP now saying that she engaged in a malicious prosecution. And that shows the kind of disrespect for the state's attorney's office. I mean, it's one thing for a union to protect its members, Mark, but it is something we have to keep in mind. It is the rarest of events for a local prosecutor to conduct an independent investigation. And the reason, no doubt, that she did it is that she knew, could expect, that a police investigation, which will take usually takes a few months, almost always results in the violence, the police violence being justified. And so she felt in this situation it was important for her staff to follow the evidence. I've attended each of the three trials, and I can tell you that the evidence supports the charges against each of the first three officers.
Well, the judge didn't think so.
When I say supports, Mark, I'm saying that the charges should have been brought, and we have to keep in mind that two of the officers, in my opinion, were really quite fortunate in not being convicted. The trial jury in Officer Porter's case nearly convicted him on two of the four crimes that he was charged. And when I listened to the evidence against Officer Goodson, I could certainly see why or how a reasonable fact finder could conclude that he too was guilty of some of the charges.
So, but one of the things that
I don't know, disagree, Mark, totally disagree.
Go ahead, Tom, jump in.
The bottom line is they were acquitted. I mean, Doug, you may not agree with it, but they were acquitted. You have to face the facts. Judge Williams gave a thorough and distinct decision. It took him, I think, 40 minutes to read through the reasons he wasn't convinced. Bottom line, they were acquitted. And I think we have to face facts that's the reality. This is the legal system we have. It's the best one in the world. I agree with you that Marilyn Mosby had every right to bring those charges. But the other reality is they were acquitted.
Well, I mean, what does being acquitted have to do with the you're losing me, Tom. What does that have to do with justice and the pursuit of justice?
Well,
there's always going to be a division in terms of how the fact finder views the facts, whether he lays it out in 35 pages or whether he lays it out in 2 pages. What difference does it make?
Well, but what I'm saying is, bottom line, he hasn't been able to get convictions on two of the officers, and Doug's talking about, well, maybe they could have this or that. Bottom line, they were acquitted, and I think you have to look at that and then make determinations based on the upcoming trials as far as what your strategy would be in those and how you proceed moving forward.
So let me open the phones here. I mean, I get some listeners who are calling in at 410-319-8888, because I think that this is it really does beg a lot of questions here. I mean, if every one of the officers coming up now, if they're tried, most likely will ask for a bench trial. In other words, for the judge to be judge and jury, to judge to make the decision, which changes the nature of how these trials might go, because you're not arguing for a jury. You're arguing for this judge who's already said he thought your evidence was shaky, that you didn't prove anything when it came to a rough ride, that there are a lot of pieces here that didn't fit for him. And if they're appearing before him again on the same charges without a new approach or a new strategy, there's no way that Mosby can win any of these cases or her office can win these cases.
But Mark, the thing we also have to always keep in mind is the severity of these attacks on an elected official. So it is a rare event for officers to be charged, and an extraordinary event, frankly, for an officer anywhere in this country to be convicted of a crime. I mean, it's something where officers have near immunity from a criminal conviction. At least that's what the research shows. So when you have a public official who's being excoriated not only by the police union and by former prosecutors who I expect never prosecuted officers when the person killed was Freddie Gray or people who, you know, fall within Freddie Gray's background. So you have here a prosecutor who's speaking for Freddie Gray, who's saying, when you have a person placed in the back of a van who's shackled and handcuffed and placed face down on the metal van inches away from a wall, and everyone concedes that the van driver is responsible for protecting and safeguarding this person, but the entire time, Mark, Officer Goodson was outside the van, never had any contact with Freddie Gray, never searched him as every van driver is supposed to do, never made sure he was safe while in the van, never checked on him, never talked to him, never did anything. Now, if he's the one who's primarily responsible, how then is an entire community going to accept the outcome, knowing that when you're tried before a judge, it's extremely unlikely that the proof is going to meet the very heavy standard? And that's not casting any aspersion anywhere. It's really just stating a reality that.
You're arguing the case that they put forward, but I'm saying the case didn't stick. It didn't stick. I mean that is. I mean, and so I think that the there's a larger question here of equal justice in the society that has to be dealt with, and what these prosecutions mean. But I mean, I'm of the four of you the only one who's not a lawyer. But but the common wisdom is watching these trials, Dwight, is that people that it was difficult for her to get a conviction in the first case, and it was impossible.
Well, you know the theory that I've said over and over, Mark. I've said it on your show, that the cases were impregnated with reasonable doubt from the get-go when we go back to the medical examiner's office and their conflicting findings in terms of where the injuries occurred when the whole world saw what condition Freddie Gray was when he was put in the van, number one. Number two, I have never expected and never seen a police department cooperate when the police department has people that are under investigation. You tie in the FOP and you tie in the police department, you don't expect them to cooperate. They're always the opposition, even if they're supposed to be cooperating. Here we find out in the testimony that there was a possibility of the police officers sabotaging this whole investigation. And so she had certain obstacles that were inherent in what she was trying to do in terms of a just prosecution from the beginning. And so those defects have to be taken into consideration. I think the major question that you're leading to is the upcoming trials. Well, we don't know particularly what she has in terms of the lieutenant who has a supervisor responsibility. Remember something else I said on your show too, Mark, is that this was kick the can down the road. It wasn't me. Or in the case of Nehru, Miller said it was my doing. It wasn't his doing. Then when you get to Porter says, I told Goodson, and then you get to the trial of Goodson. Porter didn't tell me. And so you can only kick the can, but so far. At some point in time, the can has to come to a stop.
So let me open the phones here, unless anybody's dying to jump in. 410-319-8888, your thoughts on all this? Let's go to Kim. Kim Jones in Annapolis, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm not much on the charges that were being brought against the officers, but I do think the case was prejudiced when the mayor gave Freddie Gray family money before the officer was even brought on trial. To me, after that occurred, there was going to be no conviction of the officers. They were just going to sweep it under the rug, just like they're doing now. Say the family is satisfied with the money that was given them, and move forward, business as usual.
So, but McKim, why? Well, I want to turn to Dwight here, who's handled a lot of these cases, and Tom jump in as well. But I mean, why do you think that would have affected the trials?
Well, because the city was already admitting guilt. We admit guilt by giving them the money, by giving restitution for the death of Freddie Gray. That in turn let the city off. Well, we're not going to prosecute our officers for the mere fact that we admitted guilt and we gave, what, $5.3, $6.3 million to Freddie Gray. So this is the cost of life in Baltimore. Simple as that.
Well, the other interpretation of that is if the city was making an admission by the allocation of those funds to the Freddie Gray family, if that prejudiced anything, it should have prejudiced in favor of conviction, I think, we're assuming responsibility.
Right.
That a wrong was committed.
And we also have to say this civil settlement happened before they even brought the civil case.
That's what's, irregular about that.
Right.
But the two are separate and apart. But I understand that there is a psychological presence of the money flowing that is inherent and can't be removed from what happens in the criminal side.
Let me go. Did you want to say something, Doug?
Just that municipalities, governments often are prepared to pay money to compensate for someone dying. But it's really rare to hold a police officer criminally responsible, and that, in my opinion, is what's needed to deter against police misconduct, wrongdoing, criminality.
The payoff of the 6.4 was a political decision.
Right.
That was a political decision based on what was happening on the ground in Baltimore City. That should have nothing to do with what the legal conclusions would be, and it didn't really in terms of the first trial, in terms of Porter, because the jury hung. And it obviously should not influence the fact-finding decision of Judge Williams.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Nick in Crofton. You're on the air.
Hey, Mark.
Good morning.
Great discussion as usual. I like the man that you have, the guest that you have on the phone who – I might be kind of paraphrasing here, Mark, but I think he's saying get over it. The acquittal is acquittal, and you better get used to it or something like that. And if you can hear me, sir, answer this question for me. Exactly what was Freddie Gray charged with again? Can you answer that question?
That is a very good question because I've said over and over and over. You might have had reasonable suspicion to chase him under the Supreme Court case of Wardlow. You might have had reason to search him under the Supreme Court case of Terry versus Ohio. But they have never answered the question of what the probable cause for the arrest was in the first place. I thought that Freddie Gray, when they caught him, he surrendered and what have you. How does he get down on his face with an officer's knee in his back of his neck without probable cause? Maybe somebody, Doug, you've been there. Maybe you can tell me what the probable cause came out in factually.
No, I mean, the simple fact is that Freddie Gray did not commit a crime. He did not do anything wrong. He should not have been placed in the van. None of this really should have happened. The police, of course, do have legal grounds to chase somebody who's running from them, and that's a decision which really has horrible consequences, particularly for people of color, people living in the inner city, because for the most part, people in other neighborhoods could run, and they're not going to be found to have reasonable suspicion. But, Mark, one of the other things that's happening here and that's been playing out during the trial is that the police in our city and through most of Maryland have a power that's not exercised in most of the rest of the country. And that is, we understand that police make arrests, but in every other part of the country that I'm aware, it's the prosecutor who decides whether the arrest warrants a prosecution, warrants the bringing of charges. Here it's the police who arrest and bring the charges. And that's one of the undercurrents here that we see when the prosecutor says no charges against Freddie Gray and charges against the six officers. the union police are aghast. They're saying, wait a second, that's our job. We're the ones who investigate. We're the ones who file charges. And frankly, there is a power struggle that's going on two levels. One is between the state's attorney's office and the police about charging, and the other is between the police commissioner who sets the rules and sets the orders and the police on.
There's been a power struggle between the state's attorney and the police under Jessamy and now under Mosby. There wasn't so much one under Bernstein. The relationship was much tighter. I mean, that's part of what people are calling into question, I think, as well. Is where all that lives. And Tom, do you want to jump in, Tom, before I go back to the phones?
Yeah, I'm actually here.
Oh, are you? Come on up.
I'm going to come into the studio in a minute. But as far as that, ultimately the prosecutors have a decision to make as far as whether to press charges or not. Once the charges are brought by the police, the prosecutors can make a decision to drop the charges. So I think that system is already there. But I do agree, there's a distinction. Some places it doesn't even get that far. Whereas here it does. So it's a different system. There's no question.
Let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Bill in Northeast, you're on the air. Welcome.
Let me just say hello to everybody.
Morning. Hey,
and 2 points. First of all, Tom said this is the best justice system in the world. I sure would like to know how he comes to that conclusion, unless he's studied every justice system around the world, which I doubt. But then, personally, I think that what Marilyn Moses has done is that I think that she's pulling the covers off how the police and the state prosecutor normally work together. So I think that that's a good thing coming out of this, is that people get a chance to really see how corrupted this system is. And I think that's why it's an attack on Marilyn Moses the way it is from the FOP and other people, because I think that the system is being rebuilt by how it normally conducts itself in reference to black people and poor people.
Yeah, I really agree with what Bill's saying, Mark, because what he's talking about here is a prosecutor who's doing something that will not be popular. I mean, that's the understatement, I suppose, that will be so unpopular among the established forces in law enforcement in our society that it almost cuts against her interest. And then when you put a gag order on and she can't even respond to any of the accusations that are being made here, she has to remain silent. So I think it's just very important, you know, to keep in mind that our justice system is far from perfect, has many places where improvements are needed, particularly in terms of justice for poor people, justice for people of color. And until we begin to look at the system not as the best in the world, but as one where an entire community has to agree on the things that should be done.
Well, I think we have a break here and come right back and come back to the phones. And Jason and Clarence, the next two callers up, the other callers calling in. And I do want to raise the issue as we come back from break here, though. I mean, I remember in the very beginning when we started these programs, talking about the trials that were leading up to them. People on this program were talking about the dangers of the case that the state's attorney brought, because it was only an 11-day investigation that did not give her enough time to really understand the facts to bring to the conclusion. Police may take too long, but people have argued, watch these cases. She might not be able to win them because not enough thought was given to her before she decided to go after them. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Mark Sano. Good to have you with us here. We have lots of folks calling in as we are joined by Dwight Pettit, one of our leading defense attorneys in Baltimore City, who also is Mr. West's family's attorney in the civil case against the city. Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, who has led the charges in the state and around bail reform and more. And Tom Ronick, who is an attorney and host of his own Tom Moore Show on CBM, and you all at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkinsanishow.org by email. But then we'll go right to the phones. And Dayson, I think it's Dayson, either Dayson or Dyson. Clarence, Donna, we're going to come to your calls, so just hold on. We're going to get there. But what I raised the issue, we might add a little bit during break about this as well. There were people who argued on this program in the beginning that the cases were brought too soon, that while the police may take 30 to 60 to 70 days, 90 days to do an investigation, that stretches it out much too long and usually ends up just defending the police officer. But this was just much too short a time to really adequately get under what was going on to really understand all the issues in this case. And then I have a second part to that, but we'll get to that later. Gentlemen?
I thought that Marilyn certainly...
Tom Ronick.
Yeah, hi, everybody. I thought Marilyn had a lot of pressure on her. I thought that in order to get something done, she needed to take some time, but she also had pressure that wanted to see charges brought if she had enough there. And obviously, she felt she had enough to bring at least some charges right away. Something else I'll point out. You see a lot of what's called wall charging, where you'll see what the police put forth in a report, and the prosecutors will put a number of different charges on that could be supported by the facts. But they may not ultimately go forward on all of the charges. They might drop some of the charges when the matter actually goes to trial. So to me, it wasn't clear whether she was going to do that or not. But I think given the scope of this, given the size of this case, I think she felt the charges she put forth, she had to go forward on.
Dwight, let me take a good.
Well, you know, Tom hit it on the head. We have to go back. It's easy to Monday morning quarterback, but you go back in time. She was caught between a rock and a hard place. We had the city in flames. She was waiting for the autopsy, for the medical examiners to give her the go sign and declare homicide. And when she got that, then she went blanket charges across the board. Now, Tom points out a very good point. She had all the time in the world to reassess and determine what she wanted to determine. So it wasn't a rush to justice because through the prosecutorial process, she could have retreated and dropped some charges. But she elected to go forward on all the charges, which might have been risky as to the depraved heart murder, but all the rest of them, I believe, was supported in fact. And just because one judge or one finding of fact disagrees doesn't abort the whole process.
And from my point of view, Mark, and I've been a defense lawyer my whole life, and I see prosecutors getting indictments within 72 hours from arrest. That's the way it's done in New York City and other places, too. So whether you talk about an 11-day investigation or from the date that Freddie Gray went to the hospital on April 12th until May 1st, which is 19 days, that's plenty of time to do the investigation that needs to be done. What we see over and over again is that when police investigate, they delay the event for so long that it's out of the public consciousness. And so when the state's attorney, former state's attorneys, would then have the press conference and say, well, we did this long investigation, but we looked high and low, but we could not find sufficient evidence. This is a tragedy. It's horrible. There, what we're getting is something that amounts to a foregone conclusion. And when I'm looking at Ms. Mosby, frankly, the fact that she doesn't have the full cooperation of police, the fact that most of the police officers who come into court are looking to assist the defense, that leads me to want to see a different type of police expert witness at the Lieutenant Rice's trial. And what I would like, frankly, is I would like police officers retired or from other states to come in and A, tell us that a general order from the commissioner is something that has to be followed. Tell us that the police do not have the final word, the final discretion, but if they decide to disobey an order, they have to explain why they disobeyed it. Tell us when you're a van driver, for instance, what it means when you take a prisoner into custody and what you're supposed to be doing, and how do you explain someone staying outside the van? When we talk about depraved indifference, Mark, if that person in the back of the van was a loved one and the police left our loved one in that situation, and the person primarily responsible and the officers who first placed him there did not check, did not say, yes, we should go. There were officers who said, I think we should go to the hospital. There were officers who said, right. Central Booking's not going to take him. But that wasn't enough.
Well, I hear that. And you said that over and over again on the show. And you made that. But the point is that for whatever reason, that didn't hold water in terms of being able to prove a rough ride. That was the problem, right?
The rough ride was not the centerpiece of the prosecution's case.
Exactly.
And it's really important, Mark, because the way media reports something is not necessarily the way it's happening in the courtroom. So part of the prosecution opening was a rough ride. But they also talked about the safety issues. They also talked about
And they couldn't prove it. Doug, they couldn't prove it. Well, Judge Williams said, I'm not convinced.
Okay,
you put forth the strategy.
But that doesn't mean, Tom, that you didn't prove it, because one finder of fact says...
They had a jury that they couldn't get a conviction on quarter, and then they had two trials with
Judge Williams.
He's a very fair judge.
And Doug is correct. I mean, I had problems with this going with the rough ride when they knew they had problems with that. But if you put the whole circumference in terms of what the state said, in terms of the responsibility, in terms of what the Goodson was the main person because he was a driver, what he knew, even if you get past the hearsay question of what Porter told him or what have you, but that Goodson knew the condition that he was in, you put all that together, that was the basis of what I can continue to argue would have justified reckless endangerment or misconduct in office, and possibly manslaughter.
It absolutely would have been a pathway there, and I'm not disputing that, but I'm just saying in this particular instance they weren't able to do it. And
right.
I think something you said in The Sun, we were both quoted in The Sun on this, as far as how Marilyn would proceed on the next case, focusing on that supervisory aspect. Because if she's going to focus on whether or not Rice knew or should have known what was going on, whether or not he knew or should have known whether or not Gray was cuffed in, whether he was buckled in, that's where she might have more of a pathway on Lieutenant Rice, I would think, if anything.
So let me go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to line 3. And Dayson, is it? You're on the air. Good morning. You there?
Mark?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We got you. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to everybody on the show. I basically want to say this. No disrespect to what Ms. Mosley did, because she did an extraordinary thing that has never been done before. She charged the police officers, which we very rarely ever see. But what I want to say is, basically, the Baltimore City citizens were not upset because we thought about a rough ride. We was upset when we seen that video, the surface, of that boy being dragged to the, to the paddy wagon, and he was broke up beforehand. It was clear that this man was already severely injured. And all of a sudden, the media put the focus on to rough ride, and I believe that basically took all the pressure off the real culprit, which was the first arresting officer who injured this man, who basically severed his spine beforehand. You know what I'm saying? And everybody, took their attention off of that and put it on. And I couldn't believe that she gave the most serious charge to the van driver. Like, if me and you, Mark, if we go beat somebody up and they sustain injuries, and then later on they die, we're going to get charged with murder.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So that's what I have an issue with.
And that's why the prosecution, I've always argued, was miscued from the beginning. Because the public was confused and reasonable doubt was sown because everybody saw one thing and the medical examiner said something else. Plus, will somebody please answer the question, what was the crime that was probable cause for Freddie Gray to be arrested for? I still don't have a clear picture of that.
So what's happened, what's important in the courtroom is that evidence must be presented there. So whatever we're hearing, and I certainly have heard it in hearsay from others who say they saw what took place when Freddie Gray was apprehended, those witnesses must come forward. But the problem is that it's very difficult to come forward and testify against police officers.
Except that we had this conversation on the show the other week when you were in the room and Dominique Stevenson was sitting where Tom is sitting. Who is a community activist and has been around a long time and works right in the center where Freddie Gray was arrested and where they created their Tubman House. And one of the things she said was, why did Marilyn Mosby go ask the people who were the witnesses to testify or to make some kind of statement to them. They knew who they were. They're not hard to find. They were all over the place. They've been on every other news program. The people who took the videos, the people who were heard in the videos saying, look at that boy's leg, it's broke. Why are you dragging him? Take him to the doctor. I mean, so that never took place. And you said on this program before, Dwight, that maybe it might have made sense for the state's attorney, Mosby, too, and her office to have gotten other opinions of other medical examiners other than just the city to see what might have taken place. I mean, that and what Dason was saying is exactly what people are thinking in the city. Many people are thinking in Baltimore, I think.
Well, you know, and it's a good point. And the only thing that I go back to, and this might be superfluous, but you got to remember, Ms. Mosby had only been in office, what, 4 months? She really was operating with Bernstein's staff. That's not to incriminate anybody. I'm just talking about reality. She really
was letting go quite a few
people. The office was in transition. She really did not have her people around her in terms of whatever advice that she was getting from the beginning. She just got there, and so whatever that's worth, it's fact to be considered.
So, you guys want to comment?
It's a tough job. Dwight's absolutely right. I mean. I hate to make this comparison, but for the sake of this, I'll make the comparison. When President Bush had 9/11 thrust on him when he did, without getting into how he handled it, that's a terrible thing to have to deal with right after you get in the office. And the same type of thing on a much smaller scale, obviously, in Baltimore for Marilyn Mosby. This is a massive national story. It's following a national trend. This happened right after Ferguson had occurred. So whatever she did, there was going to be somebody who'd point a finger and said, who would say, you did something wrong. There's just no way you could avoid it.
If she won the cases this last 2 weeks, she wouldn't have won the cases.
In
some of the court of public opinion. I mean, you have, let me just read this. You have Delegate
McDonough,
who started an online petition calling for the resignation of Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby.
Well, you know what Pat's going to say.
Yeah, right.
I'll respond on that since I've worked with the guy since 2003. But
the people of Maryland, and specifically Baltimore, have had enough of Marilyn Mosby's political grandstanding, he says. This was a baseless, malicious prosecution from the beginning, and she should drop the remaining charges and then resign. Well, I'm not surprised we hear that from Pat McDonough.
No, me neither.
But Pat McDonough represents the opinion of a number of people in
and
our
Pat
world.
McDonough, like others, have access to media, and he's able to get his point of views across, where others who would commend Ms. Mosby for not following the same old process of letting the police investigate, coming back with their recommendation of no charges. I mean, Mark, have we ever had a police investigation that has led to a recommendation of criminal charges? I don't think so. And so what Ms. Mosby's doing is she's newly elected, she's coming into an office, she's fresh, and she's bringing in people from the outside. Many of the people who were part of this investigation were not career prosecutors who hadn't prosecuted in situations like the one that Freddie Gray experienced. And so they're able to kind of cut through a lot of the same old way of doing things. And I still give her enormous credit because she's taking a first step. The first step here is that we now learn much more about police practices. It's no wonder that the police supporters are calling for her dismissal. They really don't want to see another police defendant trial, and they're pretty confident that if somebody else was in office, that would be the result.
May I jump in on that? I've known Pat since 2003 when I started my radio show on WCBM. Pat has a perspective. I often vehemently disagree with him on it, but that's his perspective. He's an outsider. He's not someone who's involved in this. He's hearing from some members of his constituents who feel that, look, she couldn't get convictions. I don't know why she even brought it. That's essentially how he's reacting. But it's not somebody who's involved deeply in the process and can give an informed opinion from the perspective of someone involved in it.
No, but I mean, I'm not going to get into the whole Pat McDonough conversation. you know, but things he's raised in the past, I mean, are borderline, if not outright racist, when it comes to his attacks on people and things he's supported in the county. I'm not surprised that this came out. from that quarter. But, I mean, it's there. That's why we had to address it.
Right.
Let me open the phones here again. 410-319-8888. Let's see. I'm looking at the list, see if some folks we haven't heard from in a while. Let's go to Sean in Columbia. You're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Very well.
Mark, I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome, welcome.
I'm a political science scientist by training, and I think this discussion is interesting, but I think we have to go back to, you know, the so-called concept of the state of nature prior to there being rules and civilizations, and remember the fact that rules, rights, government, police, all these things were created originally for people that had property or possession to have those possessions protected. And so to think that a system is going to turn around and do anything other than go after the marginalized people in the society, it's a big deal. So I say the prosecutor won just by bringing the charges, because the fact is it's not training that's going to change any of this. It's not laws that's going to change any of this. This will change when police officers that do bad things are punished. Now, in this case, maybe just going through the trial is the worst that'll go that'll happen to them. But, you know, these things tend to build on top of each other. So next time, maybe we do get a conviction. So I'm totally supportive of her, and I think everything that she did is great.
Sean, thanks so much for that call. Let me get a couple calls in. We'll come right back to the panel. 410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Hi, Donna. Good morning.
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well.
And love you, guest. I believe Mosby, she came from a law enforcement family, her father, her grandparents, you know, et cetera. So she got good advice. I'm sure, you know, with the you know, growing up in that type of family structure, she knows what she's doing, and she knows the risk she's taking, but she needs to continue to prosecute, and I agree with your former, your previous caller and your guest. My question is to all your guests, and I've made this question before, what was, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, when you request medical assistance and you're denied any type of, protection for, let's say you got, you ambulance came and they decided we're not going to take you to the hospital, that's a violation of the American Disabilities Act. Why hasn't anybody looked at that when he asked for assistance for medical care? That was a violation of the American Disabilities Act, which is a federal case, which is a federal law. And of course, it's in Maryland. Why hasn't anybody raised that concern? Because that should have been brought up as well in the court. When they didn't administer any type of medical care for those 2 hours or whatever, his disability was being violated because he said he was disabled in a way. So I wanted you guys to
right.
Try to elaborate on that a little bit.
No, I think you asked me that on another show the other day. Right, I didn't know the answer.
So let me just add to what Donna just said here. And Dave Schott writes in to talksanishow.org, said, there's a video incorporated in an online report from the Los Angeles Times shortly after the charges were raised showing a slumped over Freddie Gray being helped off the ground into the van. Someone said he was resisting arrest, and he ran from North Avenue to Presbury, about two blocks. However, when he was taken to the van, video showed a man suffering severe physical impairment. It seemed he couldn't stand on his own. The fact that the police put leg irons on him seemed to be superfluous, and the police report said he objected to them. About the same time, then, he asked for an inhaler, which also seemed to reflect his impaired state. Instead of taking him directly to the Western Police Station, a direct 5 to 8 minute ride due south from a mount, where he was picked up at Mount Presbury. Another prisoner was picked up near Druid Hill about 20 minutes, and it took another 25 minutes for a medical evaluator to arrive at Mount. Fred Gray was 5'8" and had a record of what seemed to be minor crimes, about 12 arrests. It's hard to understand why his spine was severed 80% in the view of his record, the number of police involved in the arrest, and the proximity to the police station. Now he's dead. He died 7 days after his arrest, and whoever caused that death seems like they should have known better. At the minimum, it seems, there should be disciplinary action. In the longer run, there should be training that would give the arresting team greater awareness who the prisoner is and the physical state of the prisoner, especially one that seems to have suffered a life-threatening injury in the process of his or her arrest or detention. And again, this is the common wisdom in a community watching what happened and all the people that saw him being arrested and their comments. I think that's there's a lot there. I think that maybe, you know, we're trying these police, and Doug says all the time, and rightfully so, that this is something unusual in the annals of Baltimore and most of America to indict police officers for an arrest and death like this. But it seems to me that even more than the immediate trial, this really calls into question police policy. It calls into question how we police, why we police, who we police, and what police officers do, and how we can maybe change that so there are no more Freddie Grays. I mean, that to me seems to be the undercurrent here, because it looks at this moment that no officer is going to be held responsible for the death of Freddie Gray.
And there may be some administrative proceedings that follow. I'm sure there will be, and there may be action taken by the commissioner. But when you have commissioner's orders for roughly 20 years that tell police what they should be doing, that that they're charged with protecting and safeguarding prisoners, the duty of the police office is clear. I think the real question here, Mark, I mean, I've been a defense lawyer. I understand a defense's job to raise reasonable doubt, but they were accusing, or at least suggesting, that Freddie Gray was feigning, pretending the entire injury, not just in the beginning when they put him on the
van. Well, they suggested he broke his own neck, too. Yeah.
They're saying he broke his own neck. They're saying that he was...
And he was doing it for years. That's the suggestion. Fox News reported something to that was the thought they had.
So, and the police officers are always saying that somebody is faking an injury so they can go to the hospital rather than be taken to jail. That happens. You hear that a lot.
Well, you hear it a lot, but then the facts don't support it. So when the call is saying that somebody's asking for medical attention, someone's asking to be taken to the hospital, when Officer Porter tells Officer Goodson, "I think we ought to go to the hospital," there's no answer as to why the police did not do what they're charged with doing, and it did result in someone losing his life.
Nico tweeted in, "Mosby knew what she was doing. Her investigation of the police does not exist. The trial of Keith Davis showed us who what she is." So what does she do now? What are these next steps? This is a legal question. It's also a question for the community to wrestle with. It's going to have a lot of effect on the police and the way they view things as well, and the community. So what happens now?
Well, I think the main thing is that she not be intimidated, that she makes her decision based on what she's looking at in front of her. Now, a lot will be decided in terms of the motions that were filed this morning or being argued, I think, this morning in front of Judge Williams, because they're arguing about the integrity of the investigation and whether all the charges should be dismissed at this point. I don't expect the motion to be granted, and if it's not granted, she needs to see what she has and does a supervisory role make a difference, and if so, charge full steam ahead.
Tom?
I agree with that. If there's not something different, though, then I think she has to follow the advice of none other than Kurt Schmoke, who was asked about this. And he said, "You used to be a state's attorney. What would you do in this situation?" And he said, "I would look to see if things have changed since when the charges were initially brought. And I would carefully evaluate as to whether or not those changes in circumstances, if they exist, would be enough to still go forward with the charges." And I agree with Dwight. I think other than the supervisory role, I'm not really seeing it. I wasn't privy to what Marilyn Mosby had at the time. I'm not personally seeing it, but I do think she needs to take some time, step away after the motions, and see what the best course would be.
If Ms. Mosby is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that evidence supports conviction, then she's duty-bound to go forward, and I think she certainly appreciates that. What she's learning, though, from Judge Williams in his decision, Judge Williams, in a sense, is telling the prosecution what he would need in order to find that the prosecution proved its case. And so what the state's attorney should be doing is, instead of relying on police officers who somewhere in their questioning actually helped the defense, and we've seen this several times during the cases, there are police experts who would be able to come forward for Lieutenant Rice's trial to indicate, well, what is the lieutenant's responsibility when he places somebody in a van, when he leaves somebody on the floor of the van in that situation?
So,
who is the reasonable officer? We keep hearing a reasonable officer, Mark, and it should not be the officer who doesn't follow the commissioner's orders. It should be the ones who do.
So let me get a couple quick calls in here. Let's go to John in Baltimore County.
Morning, panel.
Morning, John.
Morning, John.
I used to be a Baltimore City police officer for about maybe 15 and a half years, and I've seen the recklessness of white officers against black prisoners, and it's not going to change until we change the culture. You know, so Marilyn Mosby, I take my hat off to her, and I hope that she can get somebody convicted, you know, whether it's lieutenant or either the sergeant, because the lieutenant and the sergeant make the final call of everything. You know, so those two, they should have did their job and did it the right way, you know, instead of letting that man sit in that wagon knowing that he was already, passed out. Because what I was told from that that Mr. Gray was injured in the alley, and they cuffed him and brought him out from the alley to where he was laying, and until Goodson pulled up with the wagon, and it's truly sad, you know, because it's going to keep happening more and more unless we change the culture. If we don't change the culture, guys, you know, that's going to happen over and over again, and then you're going to see more Freddie Grays out there, you know, and land on a sidewalk, and nobody's going to be charged for it.
John, I appreciate the call.
Let's understand something. I know I keep repeating myself. All of these investigations where death is involved or serious injury, they start with the medical examiner's office. And, you know, Mark, I've said it over and over. In my book, I go into my book, Under Color of Law, I go into the trials that I've had where I've had to challenge the medical examiner's office. We really have to ask the question in this case. When you realize the police are in there where the autopsy's done, they're commenting, they are really almost supervising.
While the examination is going on.
While the examination is going on. Was this some type of initial action from the medical examiner's office to make conclusions that would protect the first three, the white officers on the outside, and shift the blame to the black officers involved in the transporting? You really have to ask those questions. How no evidence or no medical evidence is forwarded to the state's attorney as to the condition that the world saw Mr. Gray in when he was put into the van. That raises a primary question, and you know I have the same questions coming up in the West case, had the same questions coming up in the McCoy case.
You had a second autopsy done, right?
Yes. Not an autopsy, but a second medical opinion.
Right.
Medical review, opinion. Right.
Right.
Mark, John.
So it's standard. That's what you do. You get your own expert to take a look at things, and you get your own expert to see what's happening. And that's why Dwight's doing that, because he wants to present that opposing side to counter what's being presented.
John's call is so important. As a former police officer, I've gotten these calls from officers who basically are ashamed of the way this case was handled and would have done it much differently. And so what John is saying basically is these kinds of cases shed light on police practices that must change in order for future prisoners to be adequately protected.
I want to thank three of you. Sorry, we couldn't. There were still a body of calls left. I apologize. I couldn't get to all the rest of you who called in, but we got to as many calls as humanly possible and get this conversation out here. I think there's a lot more to talk about, as we will be covering in the coming weeks. And I think that one of the things we will be covering, as I've said and we've been doing on this program, is looking at different models of public safety that don't allow Freddie Gray's to happen in the first place. We thank A. Dwight Pettit, Doug Colbert, and Tom Roenick. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate Thanks
it.
For having me.
We're taking Thanks a short break and come back. Stay with us. Good to find you.